This is the fourth and final episode of this very short third season of Meridian. Crossing our local Meridian today, we have Professor Marie Dacke visiting us from the Department of Biology, where she is part of the Lund Vision Group, studying nocturnal animals and how they navigate using the stars. Later in the episode, we will also bring you some more cosmic curiosities. This is the part of the show where you can hear about some interesting ideas, events, or trivia from astronomic history. Yes, history has become legend, and legend has become myth, and some things that should have not have been forgotten will now be rediscovered in our cosmic curiosities. Don't miss it!
Interplanetary galaxies,
habitability,
the near-infrared,
near-Earth asteroids,
dynamical evolution,
visible light,
radio,
the meridian,
dark energy, exoplanets,
the meridian,
the universe.
The Meridian.
Hey, Rebecca.
Hi, Nick.
How are you?
I'm really good. How are you?
I'm great. What are we talking about today?
So I thought we'd talk about something that I think is quite fun, and okay. It's called the Ig Nobel Prize.
The Ig Nobel Prize. Okay.
Yes. You might know that I'm gonna say it like a big fan, but I do follow the Nobel Prize whenever they're like announced, and yeah, it's a big thing, I would say. It's like science Christmas.
Yeah, they're a pretty big deal.
Yeah, but Ig Nobel Prize, even so.
Okay, so what is the Ig Nobel Prize?
The Ig Nobel Prize is a prize that is supposed to first make you laugh, okay. And then make you think.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so it really is a serious prize, I'd say, but yeah, it's been rewarding to quite strange and perhaps a bit quirky research, but it is actual research.
Right, so science, but you know, maybe reputable, but yeah. Maybe a journal may not take it as seriously.
Exactly, so I think they actually say that the prizes are intended to celebrate the unusual, honor the imaginative, and spur people's interest in science, medicine, and technology. So it's supposed to be like, woo, science, in a way.
Right, okay. So like, are there any, what are the examples of prizes.
Okay. Yeah. I have many examples.
Okay.
And just like looking at last year, 2022, there are a few that's quite fun, I'd say. For instance, there's one in applied cardiology, so like the study of the heart.
Okay.
And it actually finds that if you meet a new romantic partner for the first time that you feel attracted to, your heart rate starts to sink.
Oh, wow. That's
so
sweet.
I like this. Very wholesome.
Uh-huh.
Didn't make you laugh, but, you know, it's very wholesome.
Well, this does make you feel good, so I'd still say that's valuable science.
Yeah. And there was one awarded to a researcher here at Lund University, I think 2 years ago.
Okay.
For studying the language of cats.
The language of cats? Like,
yes.
Like meowing?
Yeah, like meowing and purring and whatever cats do.
Okay, and like, what did they find then?
So what she and I guess her collaborators did is that they have recorded sounds of cats in various places on Earth and found out that cats have different dialects.
Wow, like it's like the difference between maybe the Skåne region and the Stockholm region, we have that with cats as well?
Sure, but like I think on a bit larger scale, like the difference between a Swedish cat and a Chinese cat.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now I'm imagining like a cat with an Australian accent as it meows.
Meow mate.
Meow day.
No, oh, okay. This is actually research that's being conducted here at the university, like as part of the linguistics, like how cat and human sort of interact with each
other. Right. That sounds so cool.
Okay. Right? I think it's quite cool.
Now I'm getting addicted to hearing these. Do you have any more?
There is a whole list. There is one that is a bit more, I'd say, physics, a bit of astronomy. There isn't a lot of astronomy-related one, but I found one that they discovered that some people could physically be capable of running across the surface of a pond, but if that pond and the person running is on the moon.
Right. Okay.
So how would that work out?
I don't know. Like, do you wear a spacesuit while you're running or not?
I'm not sure, but the idea is that the gravity is so low that you can, in fact, run on the pond.
Right. Maybe if I could hold my breath for long enough. I feel like I'm fast enough to do that. Maybe I could be one of them. So
yeah, I think, well, you know, we had the astronaut here who really encouraged you to apply to become an astronaut. We need more astronauts. So
true. So
and they're going with Artemis to the moon.
That is true. So next time I see a pool, I should just start running as fast as I can.
To show your skills.
To show my skills. Okay.
And there's so many ones. There are a few, like, I guess, that are a bit more Australian. I tried to find Australians or Italian ones.
I really appreciate that.
Apparently, you have an animal called wombat.
Yes, we do have wombats.
I'm sorry for listeners here. Apparently, they have cube-shaped poo.
Yes. It's an honored secret amongst us Australians. So we have such a great animal to exist. One of the many.
Yeah, I don't know why it has this feature, but that was awarded a Ig Nobel Prize.
It is quite peculiar, I guess. Like why they decide that that's what they wanted.
Evolution. There's also, I guess, one of the more relevant for us is that there is apparently a program that can detect when a cat is walking across your keyboard.
So you have a lot of these videos and memes on YouTube during the COVID times with Zoom meetings and the cat walks across. Yeah. So someone did some great work and helped us detect these kinds of things.
Apparently. So yeah, there is, if you can actually Google Ig Nobel Prize and you can see the whole list. It's been rewarded for over 20 years now, since 91. So there is quite a few, and it's like 10 every year, so it's like quite a lot of different topics, and it varies from whatever they find and want to reward to. But actually, what I'm very excited about today is that we have an Ig Nobel Prize winner coming onto the pod.
Oh, okay.
I know!
Yeah, and who is she?
She is Marie Dacke, professor of sensory biology here at Lund University.
Okay.
Yeah, so should we invite her in?
I definitely think we should. I'm intrigued.
To the pod. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me here.
So you're a professor in biology, right?
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me a bit about yourself? What do you do here at Lund University?
Here at Lund University, I'm a professor of sensory biology, which means that I look at how the different senses, and my main sense is vision.
Okay.
And I look at mostly how vision is involved in how animals find their way around the globe. So I spend a lot of time looking at the sky in my research, at the sun and at stars and the moon and so forth. So this is a very dear part of my research.
That's great. How did you come into that kind of research? And have you always been in Lund? Or?
Well, so I grew up not far from Lund.
Mm-hmm.
And then I actually, when before I enrolled into university, I took a gap year.
Yeah.
Before I left, I applied to start to study chemistry in Uppsala. Then I went to Australia and I traveled for 6 months, and I spent 6 months looking for animals. So I realized I don't want to study chemistry. I want to study biology.
Yeah.
So somehow, and I don't know how I did that, I actually changed it all to study biology in Lund. Because I had proven I could live by myself when I was on the other side of Earth. and this is something I have never, ever regretted. I've always been very interested in how animals function. So that was a good decision on my behalf, I think. So I did my my studies up until when I became a PhD in Lund.
Yeah.
And then I went to Australia for my postdoc, and then I returned to Lund again because we have some of the absolutely best visual scientists here in Lund.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's super cool. Because, my co-host Nick, who is not here today, but he's also from Australia, he's from Australia. So I thought it was a bit of a fun connection there. So what did you do for your PhD and then later on your postdoc?
So in my PhD, I started looking at how spiders use the night sky to find their way home. Spiders are difficult to work with. They're very nervous creatures. So I couldn't be there when the experiments were done. I had to film everything.
Okay.
And then I went with a colleague on one of his trips to South Africa, where he worked with the eyes of dung beetles.
Yeah.
And this is when I started to work with the compasses of dung beetles, how they steer a good route in their life. And then for my postdoc in Australia, I work with bees.
Oh.
So I work with flight control in bees, which is also done using the eyes.
Yeah.
So that was the common theme.
So this is, of course, very far away from the kind of research I do. how do you like study how an animal and like an insect or a spider moves? Like, how can you decipher how they use their environment to move around?
So I use a lot of behavioral experiments where you very cleverly have to ask a question to someone that can't hear you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So let's say that you want to ask the question, so use the sun to steer straight. Mm. The best way to ask the dung beetle that is to displace the sun by the use of a mirror, for example, if you're outside.
Oh, okay.
And then you shade the real sun. And then you look at how the animal steers. So we film them and then we track and we analyze their behavior. And if they do use the sun, so they say, yes, I do use the sun, yeah, so to say, they change their direction, their roll by 180 degrees.
Yeah.
When I change the sun by 180 degrees. And that is the way you have to ask and then understand the answer.
Wow.
Yeah. And that is the part of my research that I really love, is to ask the clever questions in a way that an insect can answer in a way that I understand.
Yeah. So it's a bit of like detective work, figuring out how do I pose this question?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like escape room every day at work somehow. <it's laughs>
I think that's so fascinating. But so why dung beetles? It might be a silly question, but
it is not a silly question at all, because that was definitely not predetermined. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look back at a scientific career, I'm not that old. I mean, I'm 50 this year, so I still have a career in front of me as well. But it always seems like you made like a very clever decision and you knew why you took this decision. No, this was not at all like that.
Yeah.
I followed a PhD colleague of mine to do one project, and those animals we were there to study were not very active.
Mm.
But there were lots of bowl-rolling dung beetles active, which are the ones I've now worked on for 20 years. And I just started to look into that direction. And then lots of things came together, and they have now been my main model organism for 20 years.
Wow.
Which was a good decision.
Yeah, in the end, yeah.
But back then, we didn't know all the amazing things they can do. That was totally unknown when we started.
I have like so many questions right now, but so because I know that's 10 years ago now, you got the Ig Nobel Prize for discovering that dung beetles uses the Milky Way to, well, orient and map.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Not a map.
Okay.
If you use a map, you need to know where on Earth you are. Even if I move you somewhere else, you can use your map to know where you are. You know, this is when it comes to the nerdy levels of research, right? Whereas an animal that uses a compass, they can know, they are able to go in a given direction, so to say.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, but if I move them somewhere else, they have no clue. They're in a different country. So they use the Milky Way to steer straight.
Wow.
Yeah, and that discovery was not at all planned either.
Mm-hmm.
We were actually looking at how these animals are able to use the moon to steer by. Because animals can use moon as a reference to go in a straight direction. You keep it on your left and then you move straight if you do that, for example. And we were looking at how they use light patterns around the moon. So there are patterns of polarized light around the moon that these animals can see.
Oh, so they see in polarized light.
Yeah.
Wow, that's even another...
That is another dimension, yes.
Yeah.
So you and I obviously can't see that. Yeah. And the dung beetles are the only animal in the world where we have been able to demonstrate that they can use polarized light from the moon. Lots of animals have been shown to do it with the polarized light from the sun.
Okay.
But not from the moon. It's just so much dimmer that it's harder to see and also harder to demonstrate as a researcher. And we were going to do a controlled study. There was, you know, no moon anymore in the sky.
Yeah.
And then we had seen previously that the animals were then lost.
Oh, they didn't know what to do.
No. So we were going to repeat that.
Yeah.
And if you usually don't do your control experiments last, but since you can't dictate what the sky is doing.
Oh, no. I know all about that.
Yeah, you know exactly. We kind of need to adapt to that in a way. So we had to do it last because the movement of everything in the sky that you know way more about than I do. So we were there, we put our beetle out and we expected to roll in circles, and it was just rolling perfectly straight.
Without having using the moon or the sun? Or
yeah, anything. There was no moon. It was way below the horizon. Yeah. And we thought, okay, well, this can happen. You know, sometimes things happen. We put in another beetle. It also rolled straight, and a third one. And you go, wow, this is really strange.
How did that feel? Like, was there like a, there might be something here feeling or...
Since we had published that they were really lost when there was no moon, you kind of went, what have we now published before? But also, what are we doing wrong now? Or was it wrong before? So all of this. So we actually then had to leave. And we were trying to see where there's maybe a fire at the horizon that they could use. Because animals will use man-made light sources as well. But no, so we came back then a few months later, and now we had built like almost like a roulette table. So you put the beetle in from the center of a table, and then there is a big wall, so they cannot see anything on the horizon.
Okay, no fires or...
No, if that was the case,
That's clever here again, like how to pose this question.
Yeah, so like we need to exclude that. We also didn't film this because we thought maybe these animals could use the faint light from the little LEDs on the cameras. And then instead we timed them, the time it took from the center of this arena until they fell out from the edge. Because if they roll in circles, it takes a long time. If they roll straight, they go directly from the center to the edge and they fall down. Turned out that they were not lost now either. And I was staring at the sky because I think, what are they using? And the only thing we could guess was that they were using, they can't use one star because these animals, their eyes are not well resolved enough to see individual stars. So like birds can see individual stars. Insects theoretically cannot do this.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, which is why we had ignored the stars because they didn't seem useful for these animals. So then we decided we need to understand actually what they are using in the sky. But we also wanted an overcast night so the stars could be gone.
Oh, so like a cloudy.
Yeah, because then we could take away the stars.
Yeah.
There was an overcast night, and then we were sleeping in big tents there. And I woke up and I realized that the clouds had very quickly come in. So I just scream so that everyone gets out of bed. And it took us about 5 minutes, and then we were doing our experiments, and now the beetles were lost. So we thought, okay, they must be using the stars. So we called... the planetarium in Johannesburg and said, can we do experiments in the planetarium? And they said, yeah, we're booked during the days, but you can work during the evenings.
Sure.
So we built our setup in the planetarium, which is about 2 meters across. So fairly big on top of the chairs. And then we spent 2 weeks every night in the planetarium. And we soon realized that it was the Milky Way they were using.
So what you didn't plateau, like you moved the Milky Way and see if it sort of followed.
Yeah, and we took out all other stars and so forth. And it is very obvious once you understand this, because that forms a streak of light across the sky. Mm. It's, in the Southern Hemisphere, it's a very striking feature. And we now think that they are actually using maybe the southern part of the Milky Way, which is brighter. So in a way, it forms a very fussy moon, one could say.
Sure.
But it's formed by the stars.
That's amazing.
Yeah. But in this process, we also put caps on the beetles.
So they like couldn't see.
Little hats, They look like poker players because they are they have a little white rim.
Oh, so they couldn't see.
They couldn't see the stars, And therefore, we got the Ig Nobel Prize because we put caps on beetles and brought them to the planetarium.
That's nice.
Yeah.
That's super nice. It is. I think the Ig Nobel Prize is quite amazing in the sense that it really recognizes cool science in a way. Mm-hmm. How did it, like, was it nice winning it or getting it rewarded to you, or?
Well, it was actually when I got a mail from a Danish guy, and he said that we would like to give you and your colleagues, among them was Eric Warren, that is here in Lund, okay. and Emily Baer, that is in Stockholm now, and so we would like to give you the Ig Nobel Prize, but you need to accept it.
Oh, okay, mm-hmm. yeah.
And he went, oh.
So some people might not want it, or...
Well, yeah. Nowadays it's for science that first make you laugh and then make you think.
Yeah.
Which is very honorable.
Yeah.
Because people laughing will really think about things, usually. Mm. It frees your mind in some way. But before, it was a bit iffy if you really wanted it. So first I thought it was spam. So first I had to Google this person to make sure it was a real person. And then I called my colleagues and asked them what they thought. But we all went, yes, of course we're going to accept this. And then we went for it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Mm-hmm. That's super cool. I also, because I don't know if I've heard about this, if it wasn't for that thing, Nobel Prize, perhaps.
Yeah.
So how long are you like out in the desert then? You're like, you said you're sleeping in tents.
Mm.
It's sort of the opposite of what we're doing, because we're like, whenever there's clouds coming in, we cry a bit, but you're like, whoa, clouds, let's go out.
Yeah, we cry more often than we're happy about it, because often we want to see the sky, but the clouds are perfect controls for us.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's
true. So it's good with the mixture.
Yeah.
Well, I spend 6 to 8 weeks in the field. Nowadays, we are also at different field stations where we actually have proper houses, because sometimes we are 12 people, and the tent camp where we did this discovery is only holds 6 people.
Oh, okay.
So now sometimes we have a bit more of a luxury than we used to have back then.
Yeah.
But in a way, I kind of really like being out in the field where... far away from human populations. And it turns out that that field site is actually one of the least light polluted areas in the world, which was just by pure luck. That was not something... Well, we didn't plan to work on stars, so we didn't specifically look for that.
No.
So, but we still go there because it's so dark.
Okay, yeah. Mm. Yeah, and here's where you touch upon like light pollution. And you were also talking... previously, if these dung beetles perhaps were going after man-made light sources, like a campfire or something. And, well, light pollution is something also that an astronomer, of course, bothers me a lot, because it lights up our sky. And it also here, well, in Lund, you don't see a lot of stars, which is quite sad, I think.
Mm.
And that was one of my questions that I sort of wanted to ask you. Is like light pollution something you see affects? I don't know if it affects the dung beetles, but do you see it affecting animals?
A lot. And we can even just look at the animals, I guess, here around the street lights are going to be affected by that light, or the lights on houses and so forth, which of course which will affect our animals' ability to steer straight. But we have also done a study actually devoted to looking at this.
Okay.
Where we tested our beetles midtown Johannesburg and then far away out on the countryside. And then we compared what cues they were orienting to.
Mm.
And we find that if they're exposed to direct light pollution, like light shining directly onto them, or commercial, you know, Coca-Cola signs or some other commercials, they can use them to steer by.
Because it looks like the moon or the sun. Or
They look for the brightest bit.
Yeah.
But the beetles actually, their goal with orientation is that they want to escape from a dung pat. So they make a little dung ball and they roll it away and they will dig it down where the ground is suitable.
Mm-hmm.
So they just want to steer straight, not to accidentally come back to the dung pile again, because then other beetles will steal their dung ball.
Yeah.
So for them, it's sort of all right to steer by a street light instead. But it's not for a bird or a moth or a frog that needs to hold a constant direction for a long time. It is not possible when you have a nearby light source like that.
Yeah, because I realized we didn't really touch upon why why it's important that animals can orient themselves and steer. And yeah, now you explained it for dung beetles, but I guess for birds, a lot of them are migrating. And
Yeah, they need to move over one distance for a long, long distance, and one direction for a long distance. And then, of course, if they suddenly mistake a street light for the moon, their course will become very disturbed. But it's also then you have the indirect light pollution. That is more the glow from the side, so to say.
Which you can often see, like if you look at the distance. For instance, like I live out in Malmö, and you can really see like how Lund and Malmö turns up as this sort of like orange light hues.
Yeah, exactly. And that masks the sky, the stars, also for the dung beetles. So they cannot use the stars in the city.
Okay.
So if there are no direct light sources for them there, they cannot stare straight. That gets destroyed. The polarization pattern also gets way worse in the city. That is also important for them. So they are heavily affected by light pollution in our cities.
That's sad.
Yeah. Or the compasses of animals are.
Okay. So are there other animals you studied that you also know like uses the moon? Because you said the dung beetles are only ones that have been shown using the polarized lights. But are other ones using the moon?
The moon is used by moths, for example. I would guess that frogs use it as well. And sandhoppers use it to orient perpendicular to the coastline. And what is quite nice, I think, with navigational research is that all insects share a very common structure to orient by in their brain. And this is ultimately what we want to understand, how this compass in their head, how it works. So we look at neuronal systems and things like that. And what we understand in the beetles can very likely be applied to bees or to ants and so forth. And that is very nice. Yeah, because different animals are better suited for different parts of this story in understanding how animals travel our globe.
I think this is very interesting also because, you know, I spend a whole PhD here trying to learn about, well, especially the Milky Way for me and orienting on the sky. And these animals can do it just like, I don't know, I guess they have quite small brains as well. And it's so unbelievable for me how they can use all of that information somehow.
Yeah, I think here the trick is really that they, so their head is smaller than a needle head or their brain. So it is very, very little.
That's a very, very small brain.
And the way to cope with that is I think, not caring about the things that are not important. And it's not easy to know what it is that is not important. But since they can't see individual stars, they are not there for them to process either. And they can maybe process the night sky in a similar way to a day sky in some aspects. So it is fascinating. And the trick is really to only care about what is really important.
Okay.
I wish I could do that in my private life. That is not the easiest way forward.
Dung beetles can work as inspiration in many aspects here.
Mindfulness.
That's cool. So are you still working on dung beetles or what's your research about nowadays?
Yeah, I think every 5 years, I think I should use another model system. I do sometimes, you know, with other colleagues and so on, but then suddenly the beetles show us something really amazing again. Yeah. And then we need to look at that. So I've given up by now. I've accepted that this is going to be my destiny in life. But we work on beetles active in forests as well. And on the savannah, and those are different problems, so to say. You see less of the sky in the forest.
Yeah, exactly, because in the forest, the sky disappears quite a bit.
Yeah. And then we also work on animals that actually truly find their way home. So they leave a burrow, they run out, look for dung, and then they need to find their way back. And they know which direction to run and how far to run. So they can shortcut home.
Wow.
So that is another level of navigation that we are now moving into. So yeah, I'm stuck, I think. And I don't regret it. It's very productive and keeps me on my toes.
That's great. Have you done anything in the planetarium that Anna runs?
We have actually. Uh-huh. Yeah, we went there and what was difficult in the planetarium we worked with in Johannesburg, that was what is called, okay, I might be wrong. Let's see if I'm correct here. It's called a full-size planetarium. Mm-hmm. So it was 18 meters across with a massive old star projector from the first half of the 1900s.
Yes.
And it was kind of slow. So, the caretaker of the planetarium, we were not allowed to touch this beast. Okay, but you had to change the little, lenses and tape things and so on. But you can't change things very quickly.
Ah.
Whereas here in Lund, since it's a projected starry sky, it can be rotated in a different way.
Yeah.
So that we have tested in the planetarium to see how we can make it rotate together with the animals and so
forth.
That's
nice. Mm-hmm. I really like interdisciplinary research, and this is really very interdisciplinary. So that's cool.
Yeah, it's nice when you can gain from each other's knowledge.
Yes, it really is. It really is. I have sort of a, I don't know if this is a fun question or not, because you've done a lot of research on these dung beetles. But do you have something that you could consider like a dream discovery? Is there something that you like want to figure out?
I think that my dream discovery is something that I still don't even understand that I would like to find.
Okay.
because this the Milky Way was one of those findings that is one of my, it's very dear to my heart because it wasn't known that these animals, that the insects could do this. So my next dream discovery is something that I haven't even thought about yet.
Yeah. I think that's very nice. It's a nice way of looking at science as well.
Yeah, I usually say that when you don't understand at all what you are doing, when the answers you get doesn't make sense whatsoever, you're either doing a huge, something really, really wrong that you have missed, or you're onto something really exciting. Yeah. And, pay attention because it's now it's happening.
Yeah.
And I long for those moments. They are very, fantastic to experience.
I hope you get another one of those moments.
Oh, thank you.
And I think, I'd like to thank you for coming onto the pod. It's been super, super fun for me to talk about this.
Thank you so much. I fully agree. Yeah.
This is Cosmic Curiosities. My name is Ross, and with me at the microphone today I have Victor Jonsson, who's a master student using Gaia data to study the warp of the Milky Way disk. So Victor, what cosmic curiosity have you brought with you?
Well, I brought with me a curiosity of a sort of failed theory that attempted to explain how the rings of Saturn came to be.
Uh-huh.
So it begins with this guy called Christian Birkeland. Have you ever heard of him?
I haven't.
No? He was a Norwegian scientist, lived sort of late 1800s, and he has somewhat of a heroic status in Norway, even, because of his discoveries with auroras and the like. He was, until 2018, on the 200 kroner bill, which is a significant currency in Norway. But yeah, so he started his career studying electromagnetism.
So what's the connection of electromagnetism to the auroras?
Yes, that's a very good question. So the auroras are charged solar wind. So the sun expels matter from its atmosphere, and they arrive at planets such as the Earth, and the winds interact with the magnetic field to create these auroras, this light phenomenon.
Yeah. So the auroras are caused by charged particles from the solar wind that have been funneled down the magnetic field of the Earth, colliding with the atmosphere, and that produces the light that we see.
Exactly, yeah. And the reason we only see it in specific places on Earth. It's because the magnetic field has two poles, which also are the sort of geographic poles, the South Pole and the North Pole, and that's why we only see it down south and up north. Christian discovered then, he built an experiment called a Torella, which is basically a vacuum chamber made out of glass, where he sucked out all of the air to simulate space. And then he put two metal spheres simulating the sun and a planet. And one of this metal was a cathode ray, meaning that it spewed electrons out of it.
Yeah.
And that's how we simulated the auroras. And he put in magnets inside these spheres and experimented with different configurations and was sort of able to see the auroras in his little glass chamber.
Because then these cathode rays, these streams of electrons, were replacing the wind from the sun.
Exactly.
In this experiment.
Exactly, exactly. And what he was able to replicate was these small circles around the poles, which simulate the auroras. But he found that if you sort of reverse it, so the cathode, the sun, has a magnet inside of it instead, then the light did not come around the poles, but rather the equator. So there was a big ring around this sphere, the planet, as he thought it was.
Yep.
And that is what he thought would be an explanation for the Saturn's rings.
Because Saturn's rings were already well known at this point, but it wasn't known where they'd come from.
Exactly, exactly. You would look at Saturn through the telescope and you would see rings, but you wouldn't exactly know what they were made out of, or if the light was coming from Saturn, or if it was a reflection. As we today know, it's just a reflection. But we, at the time, wasn't so sure.
Because today we don't think that the rings of Saturn are related to magnetic and electric fields, particularly.
No. It's basically dust and ice that is a remnant of the formation of the planet. So the planet formed in a sort of circular pattern, but some of the stuff didn't go into the planet and stayed outside in rings.
But can we be absolutely sure that Saturn's rings aren't an effect of an aurora?
I think so, yes.
Very good.
This was the fourth and final episode of the third season of The Meridian. It was hosted by me, Rebecca Forsberg, and Nicolas Borsato, and our producer was Anna Annadottir. Our guest today was Professor Marie Dacke from the Department of Biology. Cosmic Curiosities were brought to you by Victor Jonsson and Ross Church. The theme at the beginning of the show included the voices of Astronomisk Ungdom, recorded as they attended the summer research school here at Lund back in 2021. And I'm very, very sorry to say that this is the last episode and season I will be doing with my co-host Nicolas Borsato.
Yeah.
It feels very sad, it's been a great run, great three seasons.
Yeah, it's bittersweet. It's sort of been so fun to make all this stuff, but...
So how come you won't be hosting this with me anymore? You're going to try it on me talking?
No, never, never. I would love to come on for another fourth season. Not unfortunately, but my PhD is actually a co-tutel PhD, which basically means I'm split between universities.
Mm.
And so my time in Lund has come up and it's now time for me to move on to Macquarie University in Sydney and begin that stint.
Back in down under.
Yeah.
That must feel great.
Yeah. I think going through COVID in Sweden maybe missed my friends a bit more than I realized was going to happen. So
sure.
It's nice, but I've also made a lot of friends here and, you know.
And a fiancé?
Yeah, my fiancé too. So, yeah, I've got a family here now as well. So, I didn't expect it to be as hard to leave as it was going to. But, like, this podcast experience has been an absolute blast. I think so too.
It's been an amazing way for us to, you know, chat and like talk.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of the background work behind it, you know, we get to spend quite a lot of time together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We've really like developed our friendship over time. So
yeah, and it's great. And also I feel like we both have grown as like communicator of science.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we both see it as really important. And like, I think this was a really good chance for us to develop our skills in this like practice and also meet a lot of really interesting people.
Yes. Oh my God.
Yeah. Like I've had so many conversations. Like I never thought I would be talking to an astronaut.
No.
And yet I was. And so, yeah, it's hard to say goodbye. I'll miss it.
Yeah.
But maybe one day I'll be able to come back and be a guest.
Or yeah, I was like thinking that. The same thing. Maybe you can be a guest at some point.
It would be a little weird being on the other side of the microphone, but yeah.
Trying not to like take over the conversation. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, start asking the interviewee questions. So, yeah.
Okay, yeah. It's been great. It's been great doing this with you. And yeah, thank you a bunch.
But I think one last question, even though I'm going, that doesn't mean Meridian will die, will it?
Maybe, we don't know. No, I think we will see. You know, since we're producing it in seasons, there can always be another host coming in. Not replacing you in any way, but, you know, bringing new ideas, new questions to the table.
I would love to hear another voice join you and
thank you. So, yeah, and for you listeners, if you have any comments or questions when we might be produce another season, you can always reach out to us via the Lundabshire account on Twitter or via our emails.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much.